Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Back in the USSR, I am Siegfried, and I want to apologize for not recording a new show last week, comrades and friends, but I've got a lot going on these days, and sometimes it's a challenge getting new content together. But this is Black History Month. Last week I played a episode I first put on in February of 2020 about George Jackson, the African-American revolutionary who challenged the racist capitalist state in America from inside its very dungeons and gave his life in the name of dignity and liberation against a racist prison system, you know, and understood how that was linked to the racist capitalist system in America. You know, it might not have been new content, you know, last week, but it's still more than relevant to what I want to discuss today on the subject of black liberation, which really is going to be the focus of this whole month. The first weeks of the Biden administration saw a very, very old story get played out again. Namely, the U.S. political establishments and the Democratic parties in particular, their institutionalized policy of taking black people and black votes for granted. effectively using black people for political gain, while giving them very little to nothing in return. I don't agree with anti-racism activist Tim Wise on a lot of things, but he was spot on 10 years ago when he titled one of his books, Between Barack and a Hard Place. That was the title, Between Barack and a Hard Place. And he warned about something called Racism 2.0. And what he meant by that is that a certain segment of white America, the liberal segment, if you will, had reached a point where it was willing to make exceptions when it came to certain black people. That it was willing to recruit certain black people into high political office so long as they served the corporate interests of the capitalist state and didn't do anything to fundamentally challenge white privilege. And Barack Obama played that role well. You could say he played it to a T. He was a neoliberal. He bailed out Wall Street, passed legislation favorable to the capitalist class throughout his 8 years in office, waged wars, multiple wars, to expand and maintain the American empire, and passed only the most token reforms that did not effectively challenge white supremacy at all, or the mass incarceration of black people, or what have you. And of course, now we have Kamala Harris, a woman who built her career on the mass incarceration of other black people in California. We have Kamala Harris buttressing Joe Biden, one of the key architects of mass incarceration in America, with the crime bill in the 1990s, which he basically conceived of and pushed through in the Clinton administration. You know, and Joe Biden, who further masked his racist political record by hiding behind a 12-year-old black poet on Inauguration Day. You know, and as good as that black poet was, as amazing as her was, as powerful as her voice was, why was she there? Fundamentally, Joe Biden wanted to use her as a prop. Let's be real. And given Biden's record with women and girls, I'm just glad that he kept his hands to himself that day. Like, enough said. What we see is black people being caught between a neoliberal capitalist party, the Democrats, that uses them and exploits them for political gain before turning around and pursuing austerity and mass incarceration policies that hurt them. So we have that on one hand. And on the other hand, we have a white supremacist fascist goon squad, the Republicans, on the other hand, right? And you have black people, the oppressed, and other oppressed people in the U.S., racialized people, caught in the middle and getting squeezed and crushed by this system. Which not only doesn't serve their interest, it actively abuses them and kills them. And this is nothing new. You know, I've talked about the African-American civil rights leader and towering internationalist, socialist internationalist, W.E.B. Du Bois, on this show before. And he was talking about this kind of bait-and-switch politics back in the 1920s and 30s. You know, with, and back then, you know, you had actually had Democrats and Republicans making hollow promises to black people at election time, even though neither party was actually going to do anything to challenge Jim Crow segregation or lynch mob terrorism. I mean, anti-lynching legislation that was being pushed by Du Bois and the NAACP was in fact tabled in Washington in the mid-1920s. But to this day, no such legislation has ever been passed. There still is no federal anti-lynching law in the United States. And this is the 21st century now. You know, like, there still is nothing. I've mentioned on this show before that Du Bois, who was among the founders of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and helped spearhead the founding of the modern civil rights movement around the turn of the 20th century. You know, he was one of the first who really broke that ground. You know, went out there and organized people. you know, all across America and beyond. You know, he looked for allies that black people could look to all around the world, and did so throughout his career. And Du Bois was originally hopeful that U.S. involvement in World War I would lead to meaningful reform and a breakdown of racial segregation. You know, this is after you actually had, like, limited, you know, African-American participation in that war, you know, in terms of, like, being in the American Army, even though, like, the Army was segregated and, like, you know, they usually were relegated to roles as laborers, you know, and had very, very, very few combat roles. You know, they were, you know, there was a possibility there that something could be won, some sort of gain could be made in the name of racial justice in America. In the context of the, you know, the national unity, which of course was like, that was generated, of course, like it was very, very right wing and reactionary, that was generated around that war, which saw, of course, like, you know, numerous socialists and communists and anarchists, like, you know, thrown in jail, for opposing the war. You know, but he hoped that something could be won. You know, he even hoped that the Versailles Treaty in 1919 would lead to self-determination for colonized people in Africa and Asia, who, like many African-American soldiers, you know, shed their blood for the Allied cause during the war. You know, and shed their blood in the tens of thousands in the case of, like, Africans and Asians. Hundreds of thousands, even. And, of course, great promises had been made. I mean, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, you know, was, like, frankly horrible when it came to, like, his record on racism. I mean, of course, he turned a blind eye to, like, racist violence throughout his political career, you know. Even egged it on in some cases. But, you know, in 1919, he was talking this talk about a new era of democracy around the world, you know, making the world safer democracy and all that kind of thing. It seemed like change was possible, change was coming. You know, at least some empires, like the German Empire, had fallen apart. You know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had fallen apart. The Ottoman Empire had fallen apart. And the Russian Empire, of course, had fallen apart after the revolution in 1917. It seemed like change was coming. You know, there was hope that at least on some level, you know, the yoke of colonialism in the British and French empires in particular could be relaxed. You know, there could be reforms. There could be a certain amount of, like, empowerment of people of color in the global south. But all that Du Bois and the other hopeful reformers received, both in Black America and the global south, including people like Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong, who originally were also hopeful that something could be done at Versailles to alleviate the crushing burden of colonialism. It was the same for Mahatma Gandhi. All they received was a knife in the back. European colonization continued and expanded, with the British and French empires carving up the Middle East between themselves, carving up West Asia, and refusing to relax their grip on Africa and Asia. And returning African-American veterans, you know, those returning from the First World War were greeted by the so-called Red Summer of 1919, with Black Americans being lynched and murdered in record numbers amid absolute impunity. And not just in the South either. More than anything else, even the 1917 October Revolution, which inspired, you know, these, you know, Du Bois and others greatly, more than anything else, this betrayal at Versailles of colonized people and oppressed peoples by Western governments is what made Du Bois and many others, you know, I mentioned, of course, Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, all these people, it made them into revolutionaries, right? It radicalized them. You know, they saw, you know, this stab in the back, you know, this betrayal. And it radicalized them. It basically made them understand that the system had to be taken down. The international system as it existed had to be taken down, had to be broken down, as well as the oppressive systems within the various countries and colonies. Now, compare this betrayal in 1919, both in Versailles and in Washington, with the betrayal currently underway in 2021. Joe Biden has initiated prison reform, in quotes, definitely, in quotes. Prison reform that frees no one. Nor does it remove the profit motive from the American prison system, which is what it kind of was billed to do. You know, like there was going to be this divestment of the federal government from from private prison companies. You know, that was kind of what it was billed at. That's what it was supposed to be, like according to the narrative. Meanwhile, it's nothing of the kind. It doesn't remove private companies from the prison system at all. It doesn't address the atrocity of kids being put in cages in ICE detention facilities, like I've mentioned last week. Actually, 2 weeks ago when I did, last time I did a new show. And of course, that was an issue that dropped out of the media almost entirely. It's been dropped out of the media almost entirely since Trump left office. You know, we don't hear about those detention facilities anymore. Even though they're still there and they're still like, you know, new people are getting thrown into them all the time. And they're just as bad as ever. So his executive order didn't address that. It didn't even tear up any of the contracts, the existing contracts that the federal government in the U.S. has with private prison companies. It just says it will not renew them. Some of these contracts are going to be, it's going to be another 10 years before they're going to be renewed. You know, what a way to dodge a bullet, right? I mean, like, you know, he doesn't even have to deal with that. He's going to be out of office either way in 10 years. So those contracts are still going to be in place. Therefore, the private prison industry isn't going anywhere. It's effectively still fully intact. And his little reform means absolutely nothing. You know, similarly, he's promised $2,000 stimulus checks, which have still not appeared. And have actually been dropped down to $1,400. And perhaps even lower before they, maybe someday they'll show up. He also promised a $15 federal minimum wage, but not until 2025. He has promised to withdraw support for Saudi Arabia over the genocidal war it's been waging against Yemen. But also to keep defensive military aid in place. You know, and of course we know what that language means. You know, the arms sales are just going to keep on flowing. So virtually every executive order he's signed over the past few weeks, and I've talked about this before, has proven to be hollow window dressing upon closer inspection. It's proven to be a lie, a betrayal. This is what betrayal looks like. And it's a betrayal that disproportionately affects black people and people of color in general. They're the ones who are going to bear the brunt of this. In the words of Sun Tzu, the great Chinese military strategist who wrote The Art of War, words of peace but no treaty are signs of a plot. It's kind of important to keep that in mind right now. And of course, the great civil rights leader W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, was a strong supporter of African and Asian liberation movements, and who in fact left the liberal NAACP over its anti-communism in the late 1940s and 50s, and its failure to engage in mass political mobilization against segregation and take radical action. You know, I mean, he would recognize the current spree of performative actions by Biden and his supporters for what they are. Basically, BS. Black faces in high places are nothing but a form of racial tokenism unless they are accompanied by radical policy changes and meaningful emancipatory politics that actually empower black people and people of color. That's not what's going on right now. You know? I mean, this is the reason. This is also the reason why prominent black radicals like Cornel West ultimately broke with the Obama administration, despite their initial hopes that his election would mark the end of Reaganite politics in America and do something to stop political brutality, like police brutality and murder of black people. Once again, Ferguson and BLM would never have happened. Would never have been necessary if Obama had lived up to the hope that people placed in him. But capitalist America is deeply afraid deeply afraid of black radicalism and of black people who actually fight for liberation against the capitalist colonial system that keeps their people suppressed. This is why it murdered Black Panthers Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. This is why it imprisoned Angela Davis and Huey Newton, among many others, and forced Assata Shakur and Robert Williams into exile. This is why it was certainly responsible for the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And of course, there's a mountain of evidence there. And this is why Paul Robeson was blacklisted and had his passport taken away, even though he's one of the most popular black singer and black actor in the world at that in the 40s and in the 1940s. Didn't save him from McCarthyism. And this is why W.E.B. Du Bois was put on trial in 1951, along with the other leaders of the Peace Information Center, the PIC, which was one of the first organizations in the world to push for a ban on nuclear weapons. You know, he was put on trial and accused of being a foreign agent. Unpatriotic. The U.S. government blocked Du Bois from attending the Bandung Conference of Third World Nations in 1955 for similar reasons. It didn't want to see black Americans joining hands with their formerly colonized peoples, with other formerly colonized peoples, in defiance of imperialism and pushing for decolonization and liberation. But of course, alongside these quote-unquote bad black people, whom the U.S. power structure has framed as criminals and traitors, there are the good quote-unquote black people, like Obama and Harris, who always play by the rules and always work within the system and for the system. Du Bois was rightly angry that the NAACP, you know, the same African American civil rights organization he helped to found decades earlier, in the first decade of the 20th century, in fact. He was rightfully angry when they basically abandoned him when he was put on trial in 1951. The NAACP didn't want to be associated with radicalism and communism and lose its access to the Washington elite. It was basically banking everything on their elite connections at that time. And the NAACP was also, at best, a fair-weather friend to Martin Luther King and utterly condemned him when he began to vocally oppose the Vietnam War in 1967. I mean, this is the way colonial regimes work. Those among the oppressed who serve the colonial power structure are often elevated and given privileges, while those who push for genuine emancipation and liberation are repressed. But compradors are rewarded. White America loves them and, in fact, might even vote for them. White America doesn't like black people who say things like what W.E.B. Du Bois said at the New York Scientific and Cultural Conference for World Peace in 1949. Quote, "I tell you, people of America, the dark world is on the move. It wants and will have freedom, autonomy, and equality. It will not be diverted in these fundamental rights by dialectical splitting of political hairs. Whites may, if they will, arm themselves for suicide. But the vast majority of the world's peoples will march on over them to freedom." End quote. This is not the kind of stuff that the white power structure likes to hear. But it loves it when Barack Obama plays to white stereotypes by lecturing black men about morality and fatherhood, as he did in his Father's Day speech. It was one of the keynotes of his presidency right there. In the 1950s, when he was well into his 80s, Du Bois wrote an essay entitled "Negroes and the Crisis of Capitalism in the United States." And in a truly prescient paragraph, you know, he argues that, quote, "The organized effort of American industry to usurp government surpasses anything in modern history. From the use of psychology to spread truth has come the use of organized gathering of news to guide public opinion, and then deliberately to mislead it by scientific advertising and propaganda. Mass capitalistic control of books and periodicals, news gathering and distribution, radio, cinema, and television has made the throttling of democracy possible, and the distortion of education and failure of justice widespread." End quote. W.E.B. Du Bois was born on February 23rd, 1868, and died on August 27th, 1963, at the age of 95. His political and academic career spanned nearly 70 years. Hundreds of books and articles, and virtually every major African-American social movement of the early 20th century, from the Niagara Movement to the Harlem Renaissance to the NAACP to the Communist Party and beyond. In 1895, he was in fact the first black man to gain a PhD from Harvard and spent most of his life as an academic and or newspaper editor. That was the main things that he did throughout his life. But during his long life, at one time or another, he embraced just about every attempt at bringing systemic racism to an end. From integration to black separatism to international communism to third world internationalism and solidarity, you know, visiting both China and the Soviet Union before living out his last days in Ghana, in West Africa, in close collaboration with the revolutionary president Kwame Nkrumah, you know, who was one of the real driving forces behind African liberation from colonialism. But even in the 1920s, Du Bois was organizing international conferences in an effort to unify the anti-colonial movements in Africa with the liberation struggle of African Americans. Like, he really believed in this, like, you know, joining groups of people across borders and working together and fighting together. And he joined the Communist Party USA in 1961 at the age of 93. And at that time, he wrote, quote, "I believe in communism. I mean by communism a planned way of life in the production of wealth and work designed for building a state whose object is the highest welfare of its people and not merely the profit of a part." End quote. On the day after he died in Accra, Ghana, the celebrated March on Washington took place on August 28th, 1963. And during that march, that rally, Roy Wilkins, one of the speakers that day, asked the hundreds of thousands of marchers to give a moment of silence for Du Bois, honoring the man who had stood in vocal and active defiance against a racist society for nearly a century. A society that had tried hard to shut him up, but failed again and again. And Du Bois, he had come to Ghana in the last years of his life to work on the proposed Encyclopedia Africana, a work that would have placed the history of black people front and center rather than subordinated to white European narratives. But he was destined never to complete it. On their last meeting, he took Kwame Nkrumah's hand and thanked him for making it possible for him to finish his life in Africa. He had only one regret. And this is what he said, you know. He said, "I failed you. I failed you. My strength gave out before I could carry out our plans for the encyclopedia. Forgive an old man." See, even at 95, you know, Du Bois had wanted to do so much more. Even after a 70-year career, he still wanted to do so much more. The first president of the Republic of Ghana, Nkrumah, he left the room in tears. This is how W.E.B. Du Bois lived. And to do real justice to his life, this show would need to be, this episode would need to be like 100 times as long. I mean, where do you start even? And I haven't even gotten into like all the literary works that he produced, I mean, that'd be a whole other talk right there. Talk about the souls of black folk and all these other like iconic kind of titles, which, shaped the political thinking of a generation. But I hope I've demonstrated something about the real depth of the black radical tradition, and that it's strong enough to win through against the lies, violence, and obfuscations that currently fill the North American airwaves and political spaces. There will only be a future, a livable future, if racism and systems of exploitation, the systems of exploitation that facilitate racism, are broken down and replaced by the politics and economics of liberation. Du Bois and so many other black heroes understood that the future is socialism. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
What is life but the attempt of human beings to be happy and contented in a world which, with all its ill, has a mass of sun and waters, of trees and flowers, of beauty and love? To realize this at its highest, we need food, clothes, and shelter. We need health of body and balance of mind. We want to know what this world is, how its wonderful laws act, who its peoples are, and how they think and act, and how what they have done in years and ages past may guide us today. We want to see, realize, and conceive beauty in form and line and color. We want to know our own souls and the myriad-sided souls of others, and then to imagine what might be if what is should grow to what we wish.
The devil's devil has a couple fools. My culture's screwed cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race. But no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling. Freedom. Hold on to this feeling. Freedom.
Yo, I'm the first candidate to hate. Had to beat on the drum to communicate. Was to come to those who were hung. They would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free, boom, me and Jamal. But two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall.
I'm heated with y'all. The defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery, but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats, segregated on wax. My color got me handy. Cap, Anus, and Andy for the freedom they just won't hand me.
So true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song. Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Lillian Allen with I Fight Back. You know, Lillian Allen, of course, being like a Canadian reggae performer in the 70s and produced that particular song. And then before that, we had Jurassic 5 with their song Freedom. And we heard a little bit from W.E.B. Du Bois, in fact, before that, you know, about a minute-long clip of him talking about what is life, right? Which is something he actually thought quite a bit about and wrote a lot about over the course of his career. And what I want to do, building on that, what he said there, is close out the show with one of the last talks he gave in his life, and definitely one of the last talks he gave in America during his life, which is entitled Socialism in the American Negro. So basically, it's how socialism and the struggle for socialism relates to black people in particular. And this is something he thought a lot about in his writings over the course of his life, and he really developed it in such a way that it definitely inspired the next generation that would go on to struggle in the 1960s in particular. Struggle for the liberation of black people, and like ask what that liberation means. You know, what does that entail in political terms, in economic terms, you know, social terms, cultural terms, all these things. And he set the stage, paved the way for so much of that discussion. So I think it's fitting that I play this talk as the at the conclusion of the show. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is W.E.B. Du Bois' speech, Socialism in the American Negro.
Ladies and gentlemen, socialism and the American Negro. Democracy has so disappeared in the United States that there are some subjects that cannot even be discussed. The essence of the democratic process is free discussion. There was a time when men were not allowed to talk about universal suffrage, or the education of women, or freedom for Negro slaves. Today, communism is the dirty word, and socialism is suspect. I often refer to my education in democracy. In the little New England town where I was born, we had a high school of about 25 pupils. I entered it in 1880 at the age of 12. As I attended the town meeting annually in the spring, there used regularly to appear one of the dirtiest old men I ever saw. He was fat and greasy, and every year he made a fierce attack on wasting his taxes on a high school. I was always furious. I wondered why the citizens sat silent and let him rant. But they did. And then quietly they voted the money for the high school. There I learned my lesson in democracy. Listen to the other side. In this state, and in our time, occurred one of the worst blows to the democratic process which our nation has suffered. Senator McCarthy succeeded in making America afraid to discuss socialism or to recognize communism as aught but a conspiracy. And this in the state of Robert La Follette. I knew La Follette and his valiant wife. I voted for him for president in 1924. And I saw him give his life fighting monopolized wealth and asking world peace. My own work at the time was trying to secure freedom and equality for American Negroes. For a quarter of a century, I edited a little monthly magazine, The Crisis. And despite opposition, I spoke plainly. I was criticized as being bitter, as seeking not simply political but social equality for Negroes, for favoring the teachings of Karl Marx, and for joining the Socialist Party. These accusations were true. But largely as a result of my work and the work of others, the Negro made progress toward equal citizenship. Progress, but not complete success. The collapse of the capitalist system after the First World War brought poverty, unemployment, and distress worse than America had ever seen. And then came a surge toward socialism called the New Deal. The nation relieved distress, built public works, helped agriculture and trade, encouraged literature and art. It joined the Soviet Union in overthrowing Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan, and in forming the United Nations to avoid future war. With the death of Roosevelt came reaction. The United States not only stopped progress toward socialism, but ceased to discuss or study it, and came to regard the object of socialism and communism as a crime. Especially American Negroes, still as a mass, poor and ignorant and sick, were given no opportunity to know the sort of progress the world was making to ameliorate the plight of the unfortunate working people the world over, who were in conditions similar to ours. American Negroes were not socialists. They did not know what communism was doing or trying to do, but they knew that Negro education must be better, that Negroes must have better opportunity to work and to receive a wage which would let them enjoy a decent standard of life. They were victims of disease and drifting into crime. To remedy this, they sought to pattern their life after successful Americans. They must work hard, save money, become employers and property owners and investors. This, they thought, would bring them recognition as American citizens equal to others. But America changed. There was still a chance for some to rise and get rich, but the working classes were no longer generally able to buy land. Their wages did not amount to what they in reality earned, and those handicapped by race prejudice had small chance to overcome poverty and ignorance and disease. A class structure began to arise within the Negro group, which produced haves and have-nots, and tended to encourage more successful Negroes to join the forces of monopoly and exploitation and help victimize their own classes and any other lower classes that were possible. To remedy this situation, thinking Negroes still regarded their first step toward emancipation as being political power. They felt that their present plight was due to the fact that they had never become voting citizens of the country, and their first efforts were toward gaining the real right to vote. The young colored men of 1905, of which I was one, emphasized this. This group meeting at Niagara Falls, Canada, in June 1905, demanded freedom of speech and criticism, manhood suffrage, the abolition of all distinctions based on race, recognition of basic principles of human brotherhood, and respect for the working man. They called themselves the Niagara Movement. And despite violent attack on all sides, met again the next year, 1906, at Harper's Ferry. There they said, "In the past year, the work of the Negro hater has flourished in the land. Step by step, the defenders of rights of American citizens have retreated. The work of stealing the black man's ballot has progressed, and 50 or more representatives of stolen votes still sit in the nation's capital. Never before in the modern age has a great and civilized folk threatened to adopt so cowardly a creed in the treatment of fellow citizens born and bred on its soil. Stripped of verbose subterfuge and in its naked nastiness, the new American creed says, fear to let black men even try to rise lest they become the equals of whites. This in the land that professes to follow Jesus Christ. The blasphemy of such a course was only matched by its cowardice." This was the statement of 1906. The NAACP, organized in 1909, added to the program of the Niagara Movement the realization that the fight for Negro freedom could not be carried on by Negroes alone, but by a national movement which united Negroes and whites. they emphasize the role which prejudice played, a prejudice often unconscious but nevertheless effective. The NAACP made a nationwide fight against the horror of lynching and mob violence, and then more and more began to concentrate on the legal aspects of race discrimination and the fact that the Negro was oppressed because the Constitution of the United States was not being enforced. This fight had unprecedented success and culminated in 1954 in the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court against segregation. But during all this struggle, we knew that something still was lacking. If we hark back to the cry of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, it was clear that there was not and could not be liberty of individual action under the great industrial organization which was growing up in the world led by the United States. Production and industry and trade involved planning, and planning curtailed liberty. Moreover, our inequality as Negroes was a matter of fact. Negroes, with their ignorance and poverty and sickness, were distinctly below the average of those of their white neighbors who were educated and well-to-do and healthy. Finally, despite all propaganda, we saw democracy failing in America. Fewer and fewer people went to the polls. It was increasingly difficult to know for whom or for what one was voting, and the cost of elections arose to suspicious heights. The election in which Abraham Lincoln became President of the United States cost about $100,000. The election which made Dwight Eisenhower president probably cost more than $100 million. It's possible that it cost twice that. Election expenses today include not only direct bribery, but indirect influences, monopoly, propaganda, and deception. Under these circumstances, the appeal of socialism to all Americans increased. But the answer to the doctrines of Karl Marx and the utopias of Fourier and others was that with human nature as it is, socialism simply would not work. To me, the obvious approach to socialism seemed consumers' cooperation. I tried to plan an organization among Negroes as consumers which would furnish employment, help savings, and bring unity of action. But it was soon evident, as many of my fellow workers warned me from the beginning, that individual action alone could not bring consumers' cooperation, that without the power of the government it would fail, and with government cooperation it was socialism. My own training in this thought came from my travel. My 2 years sojourn in Germany at the end of the 19th century, where I saw the rise of the Social Democratic Party. My repeated visits to England and France in the first decade of this century. My visits to the Soviet Union in 1926, 1936, and 1949. Then, as a peculiar aftermath of the two world wars and my advocacy of peace, my travel abroad was stopped from 1950 to 1958. In 1958, I was able to make a trip covering 11 months in which I visited Western Europe, Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, and the Republic of China. This trip completely transformed my thinking. I started on it believing that socialism was a possible form of government and economic organization and was being carried on successfully in Eastern Europe. That capitalism was also a successful form of organization, and while it might degenerate into fascism and the rule of wealth, nevertheless, it could, as had been proven by Franklin Roosevelt, become a progressive organization. I returned with completely changed ideas. I saw socialism as the most successful form of government today possible in the Soviet Union and in the Chinese Republic. I saw it evolving into communism to an astonishing successful degree. On the other hand, I was frightened, and I am still alarmed at the degeneracy of capitalism and the possibility of it becoming a force so destructive that it cannot be endured. One of my first experiences was in England. I had in London a severe attack of intestinal disorder. A young physician summoned at midnight came and treated me. He made six or more visits within the next few days until he had me completely on my feet. When I asked for my bill, I was told that there was no charge, that his services were paid for by the British government. I reminded him that I was an American and that in America we were repeatedly informed that socialized medicine in Great Britain was a failure. He smiled. The only cost of my illness was the medicine which he prescribed, and that was less than $5. On the other hand, I found that Great Britain, France, and Holland, and Belgium were countries which for past centuries had built their comfort, their prosperity, and civilization mainly on the free land and materials and cheap labor, partly furnished by their own working class, but mainly by colored people overseas whom they dominated by their colonial empires. In 1858, it was clear that the end of this colonialism was in sight. Already, most of the colonies of Holland had become independent, Britain had lost the Empire of India, and France was fighting in vain to hold North Africa. Yet despite the fact that the colonial organization must end, these three great countries of Western Europe and others like Italy, West Germany, and Portugal were depending for their future life on materials which they underpriced in the world market, on stolen land, and on labor wretchedly underpaid. The political power to carry on this process depended upon the laboring class in Western Europe and America, and that laboring class was being bribed by political power and high wage, which came not so much out of the profits of the employers as out of the low wages of colored labor. I did not sense in Western Europe, and certainly I had not seen in America, any disposition so to improve the organization of work and the distribution of income as to make any essential change in the present capitalist system. On the other hand, I was astonished and encouraged by what I saw socialism doing. Not only did I see the results of socialized medicine in England and progress in housing, health, and workers' pensions in Sweden, Holland, Belgium, and France, but in the Soviet Union and East Germany, I saw a change of attitude toward the masses of people, not as the wards and beneficiaries of the rulers of the nation, but as the main body which itself owned the nation and for which the nation existed, and as the reservoir out of which were being recruited those people who were making civilization. In China, it seemed to me that the process was going even further, and that human nature was being so changed that instead of self-seeking and class hatred, which so characterized the West, that there was coming a sense of partnership in a vast and growing nation, of willing cooperation, and of a widespread content and happiness which I had not seen elsewhere in the world. All this was my deep and firm impression. I cannot prove it, particularly not to you who have been poisoned by lies and distortions for 10 years. After all, I saw these countries only partially and for brief visits, yet I am a traveler of some experience, and I know personally the trials of the poor and despised. I was given unusual opportunity for observation, and thus my conclusions are of some value. I saw the spread of socialism and communism. Today, more than half the people of the world live under a socialism which is growing toward communism. In my mind, there is no doubt but that the world of the 21st century will be overwhelmingly communistic. Returning now to the United States, I look again upon the scene. The legal fight led by the NAACP has been an astonishing success. But its very success shows the limitations of law and law enforcement unless this program has an economic foundation. Unless the mass of Negro people have not simply legal rights, but have such rights to work and wage that enable them to live decently. Here in the United States, we have had a stirring of the Negro population which emphasizes these facts. In the slave South, Negroes impoverished and mistreated have sought remedy by pouring into the cities of the South, and especially into the great cities of the North. They have caused problems of housing and of crime, of poverty and disease. It spells the damnation of youth and death of children and degradation of women. Through this, the American Negro is passing. It emphasizes our national problem of gambling and prostitution, drug using, and murder and suicide. On the other hand, the Negroes who have grown in intelligence and awareness of their handicaps have begun to fight back by the use of the boycott and the passive resistance, the experience in Montgomery, the extraordinary uprising of the students all over the South and beginning in the North, shows an awareness of our situation which is most encouraging. But it still does not reach the center of the problem. And that center is not simply the right of Americans to spend their money as they wish and according to law, but the chance for American Negroes to have money to spend because of employment by which they can make a decent wage. What then is the next step? It is for American Negroes in increasing numbers and more widely to insist upon the legal rights which are already theirs, and then to add to that increasingly a socialistic form of government, an insistence upon the welfare state which denies the further carrying out of industry for the profit of those corporations which monopolize wealth and power. The stopping of a government of wealth, for wealth, and for wealth, and the returning of governmental power to the individual voter with all the freedom of action that can be preserved, along with an industry carefully organized for the good of the masses of people and not for the manufacture of millionaires. Does capitalism offer such a program? It does not. It offers war. We have gone insane with the idea that the world is going to be ruled by physical force. More than any other nation on earth or in time, we are spending fantastic sums of money to prepare for war and basing this necessity of war preparation on dislike and distrust and contempt for most of the human beings who inhabit the world. We have no peace movement in the United States that deserves the name. We have almost no men of intelligence and prestige who dare speak up for peace. Cowed and silent, we face immeasurable catastrophe. And the first duty of Americans is to realize this fact. To illustrate what I'm trying to say, let me remind you of certain occurrences in recent times. On October 27, 1951, 8.5 years ago, Collier's Magazine, a flamboyant pictorial with a circulation claimed to be 1.5 million, published a number in which the leaders of American science and literature made contributions. At a time when few socialists in the United States dared open their mouths, and many were in jail, when economics and social science were being taught in institutions like this with the utmost caution, and when I was being handcuffed for advocating peace with the Soviet Union, this extraordinary magazine was on every newsstand and on radio and television, It predicted and described in 130 pages the aggressive war of the United States against the Soviet Union, and the editors and contributors said that this year, 1960, would see the utter destruction of communism the world over and the victorious American troops walking in the streets of Moscow. Who wrote these words and made these prophecies? The editors say, and I quote, "This historical report was written by many of the West's top historians, political, economic, and military experts, commentators, and artists. Among them were Alan Nevins, described as one of the foremost American historians, Stuart Chase, Edwin R. Murrow, Robert Sherwood, J.B. Priestley, and Margaret Chase Smith. Senator Smith wrote on Russia's rebirth, which she pictured as being accomplished by American soldiers, presumably like those then raping Korean women and burning children alive in Korea and dropping disease germs on China. For myself, I knew these writers were wrong. I had been in the Soviet Union in 1926 and in 1936. In 1949, 25 Americans were invited to attend a Soviet Peace Congress with expenses paid. I was the only one who accepted. I addressed a cross-section of that great nation. I did not, as I would have been justified in doing, devote this opportunity to describing the plight of my people. On the contrary, I contended that I was speaking for those Americans who did not want war, and that they were a majority of the nation. No one visiting the Soviet Union at that time could for a moment doubt its peaceful intentions. The reply to my thesis was this extraordinary article, which broke all rules of international decency, told lies and spread information, and yet was received with applause in most quarters and unforgivable silence in others. The year 1960 has come and is over a third gone. What has happened? Collier's magazine is dead. Its vaunted 1.5 million readers have ceased to subscribe because the reduced prices, which they charge for Collier's and a dozen other flashy periodicals, which are thrust down our throats, are not needed by the publishers, save as bait to advertisers who pay millions to make you buy their goods. The day will come, I suspect, when Life and Look will pay their subscribers to allow the use of their names. American troops are not in Moscow and are not planning to be there. But the President of the United States is going, and we hope on an errand of peace to which he has been graciously invited by the head of the Soviet state in one of the greatest speeches of our day. On the other hand, there are signs in this nation which should give us pause. There is stealing, cheating, poisoning, gambling, and killing to a frightening degree. Our exports do not pay for our imports, and we are settling the deficit by exporting $4,000 million of our hoard of gold in the past 2 years. Unemployment among our workers, despite our desperate efforts to conceal the truth, is far too high. Adulteration of food and overpricing of medicines have reached alarming heights, and the cost of living is continuously rising. Perhaps our most unforgivable deed today is our attitude toward China. Historically, in America, chinks have always rated below wops and niggers. Negroes were lazy and jolly, and this infuriated the slave drivers. But Chinese coolies worked like dumb, driven cattle. They were valuable because they worked hard for almost nothing. During the 19th century, they were not only worked at home, but were transported in droves overseas like slaves to work for white folk. When they showed signs of rebellion in China, we began to steal their land and make them buy opium, and we planned to distribute the Chinese empire among the superior white nations. America willingly agreed so long as we got equal entry through this open door. The Christian world sent droves of missionaries to make Chinese submission quick and easy. Then, just as we were stretching our claws to pluck the rich fruit of the white man's burden, Sun Yat-sen led the last revolt. The Soviet Union helped him, and Chiang Kai-shek came forward to assume leadership. Our way was clear. Despite the advice of our own General Stilwell, we bribed Chiang to betray and murder the communists. We gave him money and arms, and yet with desperate determination, China won its independence and drove the murderous traitor into the sea, where he still squats on an island protected by our guns and money. We hate China. We propose never to forgive the Chinese. We count them outside humanity. We charge them with every crime we can invent. I was on the borders of Tibet last year when China saved the Tibetan slaves, and we shed crocodile tears. We have sympathy and money for the slave drivers who hold the Dalai Lama as prisoner. But for the prisoners in our own overcrowded jails who rebel each day and cry in vain for justice and mercy, our only remedy is more jails. This shows the increase in our religion. This shows why we tax Americans into crime, poverty, and suicide, and spend 10 times more for war than for education, health, and social security. Our national debt for war is greater than possibly we ever will or can pay. This nation tries to prove its prosperity by balancing monopolized wealth of the owners of great corporations against the poverty of our lower third. What does this call for? Not a compulsory rush into socialism. Many of us believe and hope that socialism will and must come to this land. We see no other way. But scores of others do not believe this, and that is their right. They have, however, no right to prevent the truth about socialism from being told. They have no right to prevent students from studying the remarkable philosophy of Karl Marx. They have no right to prevent Americans from traveling in China. Especially Americans of eminence must stop the spreading of lies about the socialist world. A few years ago, I was invited to the Harvard Club of New York to hear a former president of Harvard lecture on socialist education in the Soviet Union. I was loath to accept because no Harvard club has ever admitted a Negro to membership. But it was my duty to go. Knowledge always costs something, and this is the kind of currency I have often had to pay in order to know. President Konert, former commissioner of Germany, and largely responsible for present conditions there, told his audience that after 2 visits to the Soviet Union, he had been unable to learn on what basis of examination Russian students were graduated from the high school into the university. Now, on his return to America, he had learned the truth. The Soviet Party had refused to allow students to be examined in order to promote only followers of the party. He had hardly got his mouth closed before Sputnik had crossed the heavens and the back of the moon has been photographed, proving beyond doubt the leadership of a communist state in modern science. The superiority of the Soviet Union in the education of children became indisputable, and her lead in industry seemed soon inevitable. America must let youth know. American students must dare to study the Soviet Union and China as carefully as they study Great Britain and France. But especially, American Negroes must know what is going on in the world today and learn for themselves what this has to teach them in order that they may preserve their culture, get rid of their poverty, ignorance, and disease, and help America live up at least to a shadow of its vain boast as the land of the free and the home of the brave. Remember how Browning once sang, "Oh, to be in England now that April's there." Today in Wisconsin, one hears the winds of spring, but listen low and long. The wails we hear are not all spring. Their moans beneath the swish of whips, the lithe thongs of South Africa, lashing civilization into niggers, with drip of blood and roar of guns and sob of mothers and babies. This is a part of the system which many of you defend. Americans have 300